This Torah class is brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.
Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. I want to thank you for coming out here. A little bit gray outside, a little bit wet and drippy. The heavens are crying a little bit right now. Probably the heavens just saw what's going on. See, I'm surprised it's not raining every day. With the craziness that's going on in the world, the blatant anti-Semitism on the rise and all that, I'm surprised it's not raining every day. The heavens are surely crying, but I guess not always in the physical form. But I want to thank you for coming out here on this day. I also want to thank the amazing staff at Partners Detroit and Yeshiva Beth Yehuda for setting up this beautiful, wonderful lunch and learn. I'm glad to see we got a little change in the menu. I see a little bit of hum and toshin. Very nice. And I want to thank the amazing staff over at Torah Anytime. It's an app. It's a website. It's filled with hundreds of thousands of hours of incredible Jewish content. Don't trust me. Go there. Verify. Listen to, you know, a couple thousand classes and tell me what you think. Okay, let us get started. We are middle of studying an incredible, fascinating series on the Me'am Lo'ez on the Megillah. Of course, we gave a full background on what the Me'am Lo'ez was in our first session, and it was quite a fascinating background. One of the, probably the most important Sephardic work ever. And now we are in middle of the Megillah. We are up to Perek Aleph Pasuk Vav, chapter 1, verse 6. So it seems like in the first 2 weeks we did a one verse each, then the last week we went to like three verses. Wow, crazy. Let's see how many we get today. I'm hoping we might even make it to the end of the chapter today, which would just be wild. So I recommend you all strap on your seatbelts. There might be some turbulence ahead. Before the turbulence starts, I want to just thank the good Lord for everything, right, that he does. Shakol ni'ebed varo, everything that he creates, everything that he makes. And with that, by the way, I was at a Shabbaton in Chicago this past week. It's an organization called J-Life Chicago, an amazing, amazing organization. And it's everyone feels like a family there. But I was talking to this one guy, who, very smart guy, but started coming up with these weird ideas. Maybe we're just a computer program on some big giant's mainframe and all kinds of matrix stuff. Anyway, he's like, I'll never know if there's a God. And I said, wow, okay, you'll never know. If you say that, you know what you'll never know? If there's a God. Anytime you make a self-limiting statement, like, I'll never know if there's a God, then it's just very easy to cruise through life saying, I'll never know if there's a God, therefore no one could ever give me a sense of morality from the outside. But I said, I know there's a God. He said, yeah, how do you know there's a God? And I said to him, because I can do this. When you understand the insane complexity of you being able to move your finger up and down, what is going on? The neurons firing. The ADP, ATP conversion. I mean, when you start understanding the most basic things, God is everywhere. Yes, God is in hiding, right? God is in hiding. But all you got to do is scratch lightly at the surface, and God comes bleeding out of every corner, every orifice. And of course, Purim is the holiday of revealing God behind the scenes, because the same story of the Megillah, well, on one token, does not have God's name anywhere. So you could read the Megillah and say, well, we'll never know if there's a God in the Megillah. All you gotta do is scratch a little bit, and you'll find him everywhere. And if you're too brainiac and you're too intellectual, and you'd rather come up with, well, maybe we're just a matrix in some computer mainframe of a giant, maybe you need to get a little bit drunk and get real, right? That's Purim. Purim is like, you gotta drink a little, just push away all your stupid intellectual aphorisms, and get down to reality. Of course there's a God. Of course this world was created by a God. You can do this. You can move your finger up and down. There's a billion miracles in that alone. And of course there's thousands of miracles throughout the Megillah. Just scratch beneath the surface. And if your intellectualism is getting in the way, get a little drunk and you'll see God everywhere. Okay. Which is why that was just the introduction to saying, Shakol ni'ebed varo. Everything happens through his word. If we can move a finger, if we can drink a drink of Coke Zero, whatever we can do, it's all because he's allowing it, and every bit of it is done with awesome miracles. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Shehakol Ni'eh B'Dvaro. And now, to the topic at hand. We're in the middle of talking about the amazing feast that Achashverosh made in Shushan for the Shushanites. After making a 180-day feast for all the people from all the kingdoms, he makes the Shushan party. And we described where it was. There was parts in the garden, parts in the courtyard, parts in the palace. And now it starts describing how it felt, what it looked like. White, green, and blue curtains were hung on ropes of linen and purple, held with silver rings on marble pillars, with couches of gold and silver on a floor of red, white, and black marble. Sounds pretty like a pretty epic party. Let's read that again. White, green, and blue hangings hung on ropes of linen and purple, held with silver rings on marble pillars, with couches of gold and silver. Gold and silver couches on a floor of red, white, and black marble. Okay. Since the banquet had many parts that were hung out that were outside, they had to put up hangings to shade people from the bright sun. You know, today people go out and they lay outside in the sun to catch a suntan. Besides that being incredibly unhealthy for you, sorry. You know what I'm saying? Like, I know there's a lot of narrative out there that white is bad and being white person is bad and white guilt and white privilege and white that. But I'll tell you this much. If God made you white, don't try to fight the system. People who tan themselves to a crispy olive color, unfortunately, don't have good health outcomes later. If you happen to be born with a nice olive complexion, call it a vote. But if you're white, you're white. And the people back in the day knew this. And as a matter of fact, people of wealth would often walk around with themselves, even when they were walking outside, they'd have themselves shaded. Because if you were of a darker complexion, meaning that you had a suntan, it was like you were working out in the field. The wealthier you were, you wanted to be able to display to the world, yeah, I'm not outside working in the field. I don't even have a suntan. I'm like such a white color. So people in the olden days, today we want to bronze ourselves for beauty. In the olden days, they actually wanted to keep the sun away for their beauty. It was like a beautiful thing to show, look, I don't need to be outside in the field. I'm so wealthy. So they had to hang up. If the garden was the party place, they had to hang up all kinds of hangings. So they brought out these beautiful white, green, and blue cloths that were set up like tents all over the place. They were hung from ropes made out of linen and purple wool, and they were attached to big, beautiful marble columns. Some say that the way they were set up, you could actually enclose the each area, because it had all these beautiful hangings, they were hangings that you could just let down, thus allowing you to have a more private experience. How much is the cabana? It's free. You know what I'm saying? So if you wanted the more private experience, you could just bring down the curtains and have a more private experience for each group. Ahasuerus made the banquet in a way that it gave pleasure to four of the five senses. Of course, the sense of taste. You had the most amazing food and the most amazing drinks and wine. I don't know if they have anything. I don't know if they had cocktails. We're going to see soon. They served a lot of wine. I'm not sure if they had cocktails in those days, because there definitely doesn't seem like there was any cosmopolitans over there. You know what I'm saying? Mojitos, old fashions. Anyway, there was amazing food, so your taste was gratified. The sense of smell, there was beautiful, there was perfumes all over the gardens and these incredible arrays of flowers that would give off beautiful perfumes. The sight of the sense of sight was excited by the gorgeous hangings and the tapestries and the gold and the various multicolored marble floor. The sense of touch was gratified by the fine couches provided for each guest. The only sense that was not provided for was the sense of hearing. Although Ahasuerus had access to the greatest of musicians, music is a very tricky thing, because what one person likes, the other person finds detestable. Yesterday I was on a flight, and at the end of the flight landed, and then there was a gentleman, he was sitting maybe a couple rows away from us, and I don't know, he didn't realize it, but like I think he thought he had his headphones in or something like that, but he just started blasting music, and the stewardesses couldn't even get up because we had just landed. So the stewardess is like, can you tell that person? But like, he just wasn't getting it, so the whole plane was listening to his music. Now, thank God, his music was country, you know what I'm saying? It was like nice, kind of soft, old-school country, like maybe, you know, 80s, 90s country. Not very offensive to anybody. But I said to somebody sitting next to me, I mean, imagine if he was playing gangster rap. You know, the words, the language, the foulness, the violence, the misogyny, you know what I'm saying? Like, it would not be, I mean, now there are people who really like gangster rap. And I assume if you really like gangster rap, although there are people who say, you know, a lot of people like to say, when you say, what kind of music do you like? Oh, I like all kinds of music. Yeah, okay, I'm sure you like all kinds of music. I don't know what percentage of your time you spend listening to all kinds of music, but like for the average consumer of gangster rap, I assume there's not a lot of pleasure in listening, you know, to Beethoven, or, you know what I'm saying, a little bit of Bach, you know what I'm saying? So, like, one person's music is another person's Gehenna, right? So the king wanted everybody to enjoy themselves fully, so he did not play any music. Another fascinating reason given by the Mamluks: music has the ability to bring someone to an incredibly high spiritual state. If you go to a Fabringen, if you go to like a place where people are sitting together and they're hearing Torah and they're growing, often they'll sing. And especially if you know, today the custom is like, you know, you sing a song, maybe you sing it twice, and what's the next song? What's the next song? I like getting into a song and just singing it again and again and again. There's a famous line from Shlomo Carbach. He used to say, a niggin is a kind of song where it's out in, there's no words. You get to kind of just infuse it with whatever thoughts, wherever you're holding. And he, you know, it's just like a tune again and again. He used to say, a niggin, first you feed it, then it feeds you, right? Meaning the first couple times you're singing it, you got to get into it. It's like you got to put some koichas, you got to put some energy into it. But then you keep singing the same song again and again and again, and suddenly it starts to lift you up. It starts to carry you, right? Spiritually, my Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Naftali Yeager from Shar Yashav, used to say that music has the power of tchias hamesim. Music has the power of reviving the dead. How so? You see somebody just sitting there, dead to the world. And then you start playing some music, some nice, like, good music. And suddenly you start seeing, like, their head starts to bop a little. Bop it. Twist it. Okay, then their head starts to bop a little. The head starts to bop, you know, to, like, to nod with the music a little. And then maybe you'll see, like, they start just with their hands, they start like playing the beat. And before you know it, they're like, whatever, you know, like, and then before you know it, if there's a people around, they'll get up, they start singing, they start dancing, you know. Famously, somebody came to Rav Nachman of Breslov and said, Rabbi, I don't know what to do. Everyone's dancing and singing with such life, with such chiyus. I don't know what to do. I just don't feel like dancing. Rav Nachman said to him, so get up and dance. Right, music has the ability, you get into the music and it brings tchias amazing, it can bring an incredibly high spiritual level. And the Mamluks brings an opinion that Ahasuerush did not want to play music lest the people become spiritually infused by the music and not do the sins he was hoping that they would do. He wanted to make the Jews transgress, and if they heard powerful music that was uplifting, you know, it could bring them to a high spiritual place, and then his party would have not achieved what he wanted. Furthermore, the first word in this parsh, in this pasuk, the word chor kar pasuk cheles, which means white. The letter ches is enlarged. The letter ches in Hebrew is number 8, and it indicates that the Achashverosh came out wearing the shmona begadim, the 8 royal clothing of the high priest. And again, we're going to see he was punished for that. That this party did not end well for him. Okay. Vashkos bechle zahav v'kelim mikelim shonim v'ein malchus rav kiyat hamelech. Drinking was from golden cups, and each cup was different with much royal wine befitting for a king. Okay, it's all right. Don't worry about it. I appreciate you. Oh, you know, go for it. If you got it fixed. This is the man. I don't know what I would do without Rabbi Ezra Levine over here. Can we get a big round of applause for Rabbi Ezra Levine? All the time, Rabbi Ezra Levine, he helps me. He brings me my soda. He makes sure that the thing is set up properly. Okay, this has been this holder for the video camera has been a vexation since we first got it, which was a couple years ago. Okay, now. And the drinking was from golden cups. At this party, Ahasuerus was so wealthy that it wasn't like, oh, the rich people will give them the nice goblets. You know, the other people will give them, you know, so you got like the golden goblets, then you've got like nice lead crystal, and then the people who are less even so, you get them the glass cups from the dollar store, you know? Oh, no, no. Everybody was able to drink from golden cups. And more than that, there was such wealth here that each cup had a different design etched into it. No two cups were the same. I mean, you can't even imagine the kind of wealth we're talking about. Now, interestingly, the words v'kelim mikelim shonim means they were different cups. However, if you notice, when I read it, there was a different sound to the tune that I read when I said v'kelim mikelim shonim. That's not the trope. That's not the trope. That's not the tune for Megillas Esther. That's the tune for Eicha, for Lamentations, which we read on Tisha B'Av. And the reason for that is that... Gesundheit, okay. Sometimes I just sneeze to hear all your blessings. It's very... Okay. So, the cups and dishes for the banquet came from the temple. The word shonim can also be from the word yeshenim, like old ones from the temple. And that's why... When remembering that the temple vessels were used, we use it's like a cry. We use the trope. We use the tune from Eicha, from Lamentations, which is the book that mourns the destruction of the temple. And the reason why Achashverosh used temple vessels, says the Mamloys, is because they were so beautiful that next to the temple vessels, even Achashverosh's golden vessels looked like copper or lead. When Achashverosh used the temple vessels and wore the eight clothing of the Kohen Gadol, a heavenly voice came out and said, "Don't you know that Belshazzar and his men were destroyed for doing the same thing, for making personal use of the temple things? How dare you do the same?" But of course, I think we mentioned this last week, he was spared, Achashverosh was spared, because there was supposed to be great salvation to the Jews coming through him. However, of course, the party did not end well, as we will learn about soon. Okay, now, although Achashverosh, there's many different opinions on the Jewish drinking at this party. Some commentaries say that although Achashverosh and Haman tried to get the Jews to drink Gentile wine, there is a specific prohibition against drinking Gentile wine. If you ever notice, like, pretty much all bourbon is kosher. Now, of course, there's a major company called Sazerac, which owns many of the top bourbon brands, like Pappy Van Winkle, like 1792 Ridgemont Reserve, like Blanton's, like Colonel E. Lee, and many, many, many more, like Stag, like, there's so many. And I've got a real bourbon expert over here. He can tell you the rest of the Sazerac companies. Of course, Sazerac Rye. The Sazerac company is owned by a Jewish family, and they don't sell their chametz on Pesach, which therefore leads many, many people to abstain from buying their products. Their products are kosher. It's not shtreif, but it's chametz shavar lev Pesach. It's leavened, because the way you make whiskey is by taking grains and leavening them, that was owned by a Jew over Pesach, so it creates a whole problem. The CRC has a whole line of Buffalo Trace that specifically has a big CRC emblem on it. It's the kosher ones. They buy a number of barrels, like 70 barrels, 80 barrels of each kind, and they put it away, and it's owned by a Jew the whole time. However, the bottom line is, bourbon is almost all kosher, scotch is almost all kosher, some people don't drink the sherry casks. Again, but there's great kosherness in bourbon, in scotch, in beer. Wine, there's no kosher wine outside of the kosher market, right? Meaning, if you go to if I'm in New Holland, Michigan, right? If I'm in Dublin, Ohio, I could find as much kosher scotch, bourbon, beer, gin, vodka as I can possibly drink. However, I won't find any kosher wine, because there's a special law about wine called Yayin Nesach, which the rabbis instituted certain laws about wine for a number of reasons, both because wine is a social lubricant and also because many people would pour the wine from the beginning of their harvest, like pour out a little for God, which their gods were idols. So then the rabbis, and by the way, until this very day, you know, it's so fascinating, because I really enjoy wine. I happen to love mostly Israeli and California wines. I like big, bold cabs, but the reality is, so much of the wine out there is not kosher. So much of the, you know, like, and I'm always, I know that Israeli wines win competitions all the time. And the reason for that, by the way, why do Israeli wines win competitions all the time? because the tastings are blind. I can assure you that if these judges were to see that this was wine from Israel, Israel would get ratings of like 37 on their wines instead of 94s. You know what I'm saying? But Baruch Hashem, wine competitions are blind, and therefore Israeli wines win competitions all the time. But the bottom line is, the vast majority of the kosher wine, the wine market in the world is not kosher. And, you know, it's interesting because the law was instituted because people used to do what's called nesach, means to pour out a bit of wine for like an idol. In the olden days, that was a very common thing. Fascinatingly, I was reading an article about a particular town in France, and they celebrate, they have a huge party when they celebrate like the release of the vintage. And fascinatingly, the people there are very Catholic. What do? There's a huge, huge thing of wine, and they pour out some in front of. Okay. Yeah, okay. They pour out some in front of their statues of JC. Now, is JC considered a full on idol? We can get into those long halakhic conversations, but the point is, till this very day, in the 2020s, you know what I'm saying, they're still pouring out wine in front of their gods. So the rabbis, they may have made this law years ago. It's still going on today. So in any case, the Jews, we're going to see later that Achashverosh wanted everyone to have the wine of their place. So the Jews, according to some opinions, did not drink Gentile wine. They made sure to drink wine that was in sealed flasks, right? So once Yayin Nesach is picked up, it's already becomes a problem. If wine is picked up by an idolater, it's already a problem. So the wine was in sealed flasks, and because they constantly were using new cups, if you pour wine into a cup that has a little bit left over of wine that is forbidden, it can make the whole bottle prohibited. But because they kept switching out the cups, there was never a problem of pouring into a glass that had Yayin Nesach, and therefore the Jews were able to drink kosher wine. And it said, V'yein Malchus Rav Kiyat HaMelech, it said, there was much royal wine. What is royal wine? According to this opinion, the royal wine was the Jewish wine that was given to the king as part of the taxes, and then was later served back to the Jews at this party. So it was kosher wine in sealed vessels that was being now served back to the Jews. They're like, wait, I think I just gave this as taxes last year. You know, yes, you did. Okay, fine. Now, when Haman saw that his plan to make the Jews sin was unsuccessful, he wanted them to drink the Gentile wine, and they were refusing to drink the Gentile wine. So he switched tactics. He went to Achashverosh and he said, look at these Jews. If a fly falls into the Jewish wine, you know what they do? They take a spoon, they take out the fly, and they throw it out, and they drink the cup of wine. But if you, the king of the entire kingdom, drinks from a cup of their wine, they won't drink the whole thing. Achashverosh was like, really? So they called over a Jewish rabbi, and he said, is this true? So the Jewish rabbi said, look, it has nothing to do with our respect for you. We're keeping the laws of our fathers. The last thing you want to do as a king is to start coming in and telling everybody to get rid of their customs that they had from their fathers and for their generations. But just to show you how we're not disrespecting you, this rabbi, there was a finger bowl. In the olden days, a lot of times the eating was with your hands. So your hands got greasy a lot. So you had a finger bowl in front of you with like rose water or whatever it was. And you would dip your hands in the bowl and just, you know, wash off your get your hands ungreased, so to speak. So this rabbi picked up the finger bowl of the king and drank it and said, you see, we are not showing any disrespect. I would even drink the finger bowl with your, you know, that you stuck your hands and the dirty hands in. We're just doing it out of respect for our ancient traditions. And thus, Haman's plot against the Jews with that one failed. Next. Vashtiya kadas enones kike enyisara melech kol rav beso laso skirtson ish va'ish. The drink was right. No one was forced to drink, for the king had ordered all the stewards of his house to do as each man had wished. Now, often at parties, people are egged on to drink. Yeah, come on, come on. Chug, 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 chug. Like every frat party, everyone's trying to egg everybody else on to drink until they're like pass out drunk, need to go to the hospital, get their stomachs pumped, charcoal, tab. You know, there's like an intense focus. I'm like, you have to drink more. Hey, man, you're falling behind. We're already on our fourth shot, and you only had two. Dude, stop, man. Stop counting. So the king's policy was just, he didn't want anyone to overindulge. He didn't want anyone to feel forced to drink. It's a seven-day party. You know, you start chugging on day one, and you are flat-out hungover on day two, and you're not able to enjoy the party. So whatever anybody wanted, if you wanted to eat first, you eat first. If you want to drink first, you drink first. I just had a Russian guy who was at my house for Shabbos, a Ukrainian guy, actually, who was at my house for Shabbos, a wonderful young Jew from New York. I just had a program out of Montana in the winter, and I said, whoever would like to come for Shabbos? The guy was like, Rabbi, I'm coming. He made a flight. He flew into Detroit, came for Shabbos, went back home. He was giving us like the whole Russian. He's like, if you do this, you have to first eat this, and then you drink this, and then you have some bread, and then you eat this, and you drink, and then after you drink it, he had like a whole supply, like a whole system that if you drink that, you'll never get drunk. Which reminds me of the system that people have for playing the slot machines. You know what I'm saying? Everybody who plays the slot machines has a system, but they always consistently lose because the casinos are giving you 30-70 odds. So you may have won a couple big wins, and that's all you remember because your confirmation bias is that you have a system, and you want to remember that you have a system. But the reality is you've lost way more than you've gained at slots. Do not play slots. Take that money and buy Bitcoin. Your grandchildren will appreciate you way more than if you take your check and go to the slot machines, even if you have a system. The same thing goes if you have a system for drinking and you think you can drink as much as you want, as long as you have your system, there's no system. Don't drink as much as you want. Okay, the meal was served on individual dishes. You know, sometimes if you're at a party and they put out a big buffet, people like bum rush the buffet. They don't want to miss out. You know what I'm saying? They don't want to miss out. Or like even if you're sitting at a table, often like in Middle Eastern places, they'll put like all the food in the table in the middle. And then people are like, I don't want to miss that. You start like, there's like a sense of grabbing. At the king's party, everything was served on individual dishes. You could eat it as fast as you want. You could eat it as slow as you want. This way, there was never any concern like your food is going to run out. Next, there's actually an ancient Persian custom that a huge cup, which the equivalent would be today about a 40-ounce cup, right? Which is kind of interesting because this was written, by the way, by the Mamluks. It was translated from the original Ladino by Rabbi Arya Kaplan in the 60s, probably, okay? And obviously he changed over he figured out what there was no ounces in Persia 2,500 years ago, but he figured out what that amount was, and he said it was about a 40-ounce cup. Of course, today we know there is in the world something called a 40, right? Which is a cheap way of drinking lots of beer. You know what I'm saying? We'd be drinking 40s. Anyway, so there was a 40-ounce, and a 40 is a 40-ounce bottle, or you know. There was a custom of a 40-ounce cup that would be set before each person by a royal banquet, and there would be enormous pressure to drain the cup. And people would sometimes get sick and even die from such excesses. But at this banquet, the king gave an order that this cup should not be brought out. You know, a friend of mine told me he goes to China on business. And they have, also in China, they have these like long business dinners where like they're like really, really just keep pouring this like very strong alcohol. And they keep going, Ganbei! 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 And like he said, he told me the first time he went to one of these parties, right? Everyone's picking up their glasses and Ganbei! Ganbei! You know, whatever. Like Ganbei means like L'chaim, whatever. And he said, at the end of the party, he felt lamavis, like he felt death. You know, l'chaim means to life. He's like, he felt like he almost died. And like the next day, he said to one of the Chinese guys, he's like, dude, you almost killed me last night. And you're sitting here. I'm like, I could barely function. He's like, dude, you can't do gambes, just drink the whole thing. You got to like drink a little and then pour out the rest. Because like it's such a pressure to drink. You know what I'm saying? So Ahasuerus says, no gambe at this party. No 40s, no gambe. Okay. Now, interestingly, we mentioned earlier that there was four senses that were able to be pleased at the party. The fifth one, we said, was hearing, and there was no music because of the reasons we outlined previously. However, there was one way that your sense of hearing could be pleased. And how was that? Whatever you asked for, the servants would say, yes, I'll get that for you immediately. Lasos kirton ishvish. He had told all the people in the house to do whatever anybody asked for. So you would call over, you know, one of the waiters would be passing by. Can I get a 1964 Lafitte Rothschild? Yes, sir, immediately. That's pleasing to your ear when you hear somebody saying, yes, sir, immediately, whatever you ask. You know, there was a little bit pleasing to the ear in the sense that hearing that whatever you ask for, the person's like, oh, yes, your honor, I'll go get that for you right away, whatever. That's kind of nice sound to hear for your ears. Okay. Now, it says that they did that the drinking was not forced. La'asos kirtzon ish va'ish, to do according to the will of each man. The commentators have different opinions on this. According to some opinions, it's referring to Haman and Mordechai. In the Megillah, Mordechai is described as ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan ha'Bira. There was a Jewish man in Shushan, the capital. Ish Yehudi is referred to as an ish. Haman is also described as an ish. He is described by Esther at the final party before he's about to be sentenced to death. He's called Ish Tsar Ve'oyev, that hateful and enemy and hateful man. He's described as an ish too. Now, there's different opinions on how you parse this out. According to some opinions, Haman wanted everyone to drink and get drunk and sin terribly. Mordechai said, no, I want there to be, like, don't offer my Jews drink, because then they may end up sinning terribly. So the king's compromise was, okay, I'll offer the drink, but I won't force it. This way he wanted to make both Haman and Mordechai, the Ish and the Ish, happy. That was one opinion. We'll get to another few opinions on that in the end. The custom also was to serve people. You could order whatever wine you wanted, but they especially had on order wines from every province. People often like the wine that they grew up with. We like the stuff that we grew up with. We like our regular wines. And by the way, I don't know if you know this, but all these people drinking these fine wines, when they do blind tastings, like the cheapest wines end up usually winning, which is crazy. Not blind tasting as a wine experts, but like the average Joe. The average Joe, when given a blind taste, usually ends up going with the cheapest one, and I've written about this extensively in Shabbos emails. The cheaper wines are very easy drinking. They're made to be like that, you know, like the $5 Gallo or whatever it is. You know what I'm saying? It's made to be, I've never had $5 Gallo, but it goes for a gallon for $5, so it's like it's got to be pretty good, whatever, pretty easy to drink. So, people like the wine they're familiar with. So that's why everyone would get the wines they were familiar with, and that's why the Jews got Jewish wine. Now, another reason why Achashverosh's advisors encouraged him not to force wine drinking is you're going to have people, in Shushan the capital, you have people from all over. And when people start getting drunk, they get very, very nationalistic. What do you say about the Irish? You know, I'm like, easy, brother, easy. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, you don't want to get, you can end up having a lot of fights with a lot of drunk people from a lot of different countries. So they said, let's go easy on the wine and beverage here. Another opinion. Achashverosh did not want to force people to drink because if so, they would have an excuse for sins they had done when they were drunk. Achashverosh wanted the Jews to sin by drinking Gentile wine, and then they would get drunk and they would commit promiscuous misdeeds, sensual immorality. But he wanted the drink to be voluntary, so they shouldn't say, look, it wasn't my fault that I did, you know, immoral acts. I was forced to drink, and then my inhibitions were all the way down. I didn't have any choice. Now, interestingly, they were not forced to drink, but they were forced to eat. He said, if they don't drink at all, they're not going to sin. So he said, okay, let's at least get them to eat this Gentile food or whatever, and then maybe that will cause them more to drink. Now, there's another opinion that Haman wanted them to eat and drink Gentile foods. Mordechai didn't want them to eat or drink Gentile foods or wine. So the compromise was, I'll please Haman by making them eat the food, but I'll please Mordechai by not making them eat the drink. There is still another yet opinion in the Gemara that says that both Haman and Mordechai did not want them to drink by force. Mordechai did not want them to drink because then they end up doing immoral deeds when they were drunk. Haman wanted them to do immoral deeds, but he said if they're going to be drunk and they were forced to drink, they're going to have an excuse and God's not going to be as angry at them. I want God to be angry at them, so I want them to drink, but of their own volition. And then when they drink and they sin and they do all kinds of acts of immorality, they won't have the excuse, but I was drunk. You chose to get drunk. Which just shows you, by the way, that intoxication is not an excuse for bad behavior because you chose to get drunk. Now, interestingly, there's a statement in the Gemara, Chayev Inish Lubsume Bepuraya, a person is required to get spiced with wine. Spiced is a nice word for drunk. Ad Delo Yada Bein Arar Haman LeBaruch Mordechai, until he does not know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. Okay? Now, what does that mean? So, one opinion is, there's a very fine difference between why Haman didn't want them to drink and Mordechai didn't want them to drink. You don't got to get that drunk to like lose track of all these calculations. That's what the Mamloy says. I want to offer one more opinion that's not in the Mamloy. So I'm just going to say this is my own opinion. So I'm saying it outside of the Mamloy. Haman, according to one opinion, wanted the Jews to drink and get drunk. Mordechai did not want them to drink. Haman wanted to force the Jews to drink. Mordechai said no. Now, listen to this. The Jews ended up drinking at the party. And they did sin. And they were punished. The whole Purim story, one of the main sins they did is that they nehenu misu daso shel Achashverosh. They went to this party that was celebrating the downfall of the Jewish God, and they enjoyed themselves. Now, looking back, you could say the following. You could say the following. Had Haman had his way and we were forced to drink, we would have had an excuse for our drunken behavior and then maybe we wouldn't have gotten punished. But Mordechai was the one who prevented us from being forced to drink and now we are responsible for our drinking and therefore deserving of getting punished. So when a person gets drunk, he might say, you know what? Cursed is Mordechai. Why did he prevent us from being forced to drink? If we had only been forced, we would have had an excuse and you couldn't have held us liable. Blessed is Haman. He wanted us to be forced to drink and then we would not have been liable for what we did wrong. Now that's of course a drunken man's thought process, which is why you need to drink somewhat to get drunk, but there is an idea behind it. So I think that's just my own idea. That's not what the man always says. Okay, next. Gam Vashti Amalka Asasam Shtei Nashim Beis Hamachos Asher LaMelech Achashverosh. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace of King Achashverosh. Now remember, we said there were three reasons for this party. One was the 70 years passing and the Jews not being redeemed, which was definitely on the mind of Achashverosh all the time. The other reason was it was a celebration of his marriage to Vashti. And the third reason was the naval battle, the decisive naval battle that he had won. So now, part of this, so at least one of the reasons for this party was a celebration party for his wedding to Vashti. So Vashti makes a similar party for the wives of the governors and the ladies in waiting, right? All their people. And the party was equal to Achashverosh in all ways. Talk about equity. There was no 70 cents on the dollar over here. Every dollar that was spent on the men's party was spent on the women's party. Title IX sports. Every bit of money you put towards male sports, you need to put towards female sports on the college level, right? Title IX. Okay, if you guys know what I'm talking about, if you know, you know. If you don't know, you don't know. But whatever it was, bottom line is, there was party equity at the party. Now, Achashverosh was hoping to cause the Jews to sin by committing sexual immorality. We know that many times in Jewish history, the Jews were tried to entice the Jews to commit immoral deeds because God hates sensual immorality. Bilaam tried to curse the Jewish people. It didn't work. Every time he tried, his curses turned into blessings. But the Gemara tells us that his final gambit was, as he was being chased away by Balak, "You failure, you miserable failure, I hire you, I offer you billionaire status immediately. All you got to do is curse the Jews, and three times you go out there, and every time you fail, you loser." Bilaam says, "Look, yeah, I failed, but, if you want to know how to beat them, I'll give you a last piece of advice. Buy Bitcoin." No, I'm kidding. He said, the last piece of advice was, God of the Jewish people hates sensual immorality. If you can get the Jewish men to start straying after the Midianite women, the Moabite, the Midianite women, and then especially if you can include a little bit of idolatry in there, you get the men's passion inflamed, and you bust out an idol, you're like, "I would love to be do something with you right now, but I need you to bow down to this idol first," you know. Then you can really get God angry at them and they'll die. And that's exactly what happened, by the way. The Midianite women came and lured the Jewish men into acts of immorality. And when they did that, they also forced their idol worship upon them. and there was a plague, and many thousands of Jews died. So this trick to try to get the Jews by getting them to commit immoral acts, Eloka shel elason nezima, the God of the Jewish people hates immorality. So there was definitely an attempt over here to cause the Jews to sin with immorality. So Achashverosh, we're going to see, was going to try to get the men to commit all kinds of immoral acts. Vashti said, I'm going to bring the women into my party, and I'm going to try to get them to commit immoral acts too, which is admittedly much harder. To get a man to commit sexual misdeeds when he's semi-drunk is easier than a woman. So Vashti said, give me the job. I got it. I'm up to the task. Vashti also showed off the amazing wealth. She also, believe it or not, came in wearing the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. Now, you have to understand, by the way, at a certain point, there's something spiritual over here, right? Meaning, Vashti had access to the greatest couture designers in the entire kingdom. You know, she had the Prada and the, you know, and the Gucci and the, you know, she had all the you know, the Giorgio Armani couture. She had all the access to make the most beautiful gowns, but she's coming in wearing this set of clothing that the high priest used to wear. Now, granted, they were beautiful clothing, but there was a spiritual glory to these clothing. And even these sick, deranged people like Achashverosh and Vashti understood that. And both Achashverosh and Vashti come out to this party wearing the garb of the high priest. Now, of course, we know that Achashverosh was spared from being killed because there was a future that was important to the Jewish people with him. Vashti was not spared, and she indeed would go the way of her father Belshazzar. Her father Belshazzar wore the clothing of the high priest and died at a party. She also comes out wearing the clothing of the high priest and dies as well. Now, Vashti did this out of pride. Ahasuerus had become a king because, in her mind, again, it's amazing, the ego over here of Vashti. In Vashti's mind, she had become, the only reason why Ahasuerus was really a king was because he married her. She was the descendant of the Babylonian royal empire. She was the daughter of Belshazzar, the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. All the royalty that Achashverosh has only comes because of her. Okay? And of course, that's not the case. According to the opinion, there is one opinion that Achashverosh was a commoner and found the great treasure and bought his way to the kingdom, in which case, the fact that he married a royal princess was pretty impressive. But according to the other opinion, he was the son of Cyrus, the grandson of Darius, son and grandson of powerful kings who beat the Babylonian Empire. Who destroyed the Babylonian Empire? Cyrus and Darius. So it's like, I'm the most important one. I'm the princess from the Babylonian Empire. Yeah, and I'm the king from the empire that beat your empire. But this is the way people see things. So in her mind, she feels that she should have been really the king. In her mind, she feels she should have been the king. But such discrimination to women, there's a glass ceiling. We can't be the king. So, okay, fine. So they gave my husband the job. But really, without me, he would have been a janitor. But that's not how Achashverosh sees it. Achashverosh is like, I'm the king. I'm the son of Cyrus, the grandson of Darius. My kingdom beat your kingdom. And without me, you are an orphan, right? Your father was slaughtered by my family attacking and destroying your empire. You would have been cut down and destroyed in 10 seconds if not for the fact that my grandfather had Rachmanis on you, my father had Rachmanis on you and took you and made you, you know, my bride. So, therefore, if you look at the verse, it says like this, Gam Vashti Hamalka. The words Vashti Hamalka, we're going to see, sometimes the words are Hamalka Vashti, and sometimes the words are Vashti Hamalka. We're going to see, sometimes it says Queen Vashti, sometimes it says Vashti the Queen. In our case, it says, Gam Vashti Hamalka, also Vashti the Queen. Achashverosh is giving her a message. You're Vashti. You're an orphan that would have been killed. But you're now the queen because you married me, so I'll let you have the party. Okay, now, interestingly enough, the Mamloy says this. Interestingly enough, even though Ahasuerus and Vashti wanted to tempt the Jews to commit immoral deeds, they did not seat the men and women together because in those days it was considered inappropriate. And he says, we should learn a lesson from this and keep men and women separated at weddings and similar celebrations. Just reading from the Maamois, right? It's definitely an idea. I've been at weddings that are seated, mingled. I've been at weddings that are seated separately. I think even forget about the spiritual, the religious part of it. There's something when guys are just sitting with guys and women are sitting with men. Just let your hair down. You can be a little bit more comfortable. Anyway, but the Maamois says this. Okay, some commentaries maintain that the women were seated separately, but they were seated on an open patio in full view of the men, so that the men, as they're getting drunk, would be inflamed by gazing at the women. And of course, Vashti had all intention to display her charms, but we're going to see she was prevented from doing so. One of Vashti's chief motives in doing this was because she did not want the Jews to be worthy of rebuilding their temple. She knew there was a prophecy out there that the Jews are going to rebuild their temple. And she's like, my grandfather worked so hard to destroy that temple. It took him years. I don't want that being rebuilt, so I'm going to try to get these Jews to sin, and then their God will abandon them and not rebuild the temple. Ironically, of course, she ends up being killed. Her replacement is Esther, whose son orders the rebuilding of the temple. Okay. Now, next verse. Bayayim hashvi'i k'tayv lev ha-melech bayayin amar limumon b'zachar v'nel b'ksav b'vaksa zeisar v'charkas shivas asarisim ha-mesharisim espnei ha-melech ha-chashverosh. On the seventh day, when the king's heart was merry with wine, he gave orders to mehuman b'zachar v'nel b'ksa and avaksa zeisar v'charkas, the seven ministers who served in the presence of the king Ahasuerus. Little interesting tidbit. The word for minister, in this case, there's word sarim, which means minister, and here it says sarisim. The technical translation of the word saris is a eunuch. In many of the royal kings, in many of the royal households, the men who served in the palace were turned into eunuchs, because the king didn't want that the men should, you know, with all the access, there'd be all these royal women around, there could be some bad activities going on. So they would make the men into eunuchs first. So if you had nobles, the nobles would live in their homes, they would be called sarim, but the people, the regular household servants were called sarisim, eunuchs, the royal eunuchs. Now, this is also important because we're going to see he's going to order these people to go get the queen and have her appear without any clothing. An order made by the household eunuchs is just, it's already a demeaning order. And the fact that it was made by household eunuchs made it all the worse. Now, the Maamlohi says that on the first day of the feast, the men of the Sanhedrin who were around, and Mordechai was one of the Sanhedrin members, the Sanhedrin was the great court, the supreme court of the Jewish people, they assembled and fasted for 6 days. Now, mind you, if you remember, when was the seventh day? Shabbos Yom Kippur. Okay? So they even fasted throughout the Aseret Yemei Teshuvah, the 10 days of repentance. Of course, they ate at night. They couldn't fast for 7 days straight. Of course, in Yom Kippur, they wouldn't eat at night either. But the men of the Sanhedrin fasted and prayed for 7 days. For the 6 days, I'm sorry, from Sunday until Friday, that Hashem would not destroy the Jewish people. And on the seventh day, which was Shabbos and Yom Kippur, their prayer was accepted. And we're going to see terrible things are going to happen to Vashti. Ahasuerus had seven ministers, one for each day of the week. Okay? And Ahasuerus himself did not allow himself to get drunk the first 6 days of the party. Right? He was concentrating on showing off his wealth and being a good host. And often being a good host means you don't get to eat and drink a lot. I got to tell you, by the way, you know, Baruch Hashem, at our house, we have often big, big Shabbos meals. And by the time the main course comes around, And my wife's an amazing cook, and she cooks up a royal storm. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, sometimes people say to me, do you guys celebrate Thanksgiving? I'm like, let me describe to you a Shabbos meal, right? And you'll realize that our Shabbos meal every Friday night is the full Thanksgiving dinner plus, plus, plus. You know what I'm saying? Like, so my wife, but by the time we're already deep into the meal, and I'm, as the host, I'm trying to, like, you know, I'm engaging people in conversations, and we like to ask interesting halachic queries and ask everybody their opinion. So I'm so busy engaging, but finally they start clearing the table. Like, I don't even put a lot of food on my plate because I know that I'm so busy talking. So only I'll put like a piece of meat and maybe, I don't know, a piece of cocoa. It's like, that's it. Like, you know, no sides, no salads, no, nothing, you know. And then it's finally they're collecting the plates and there's still like 3/4 of a piece of meat and the whole cocoa there. I'm like, you know, oh, no, hold on a second. Usually while they're eating dessert, I'm eating meat and cocoa. Anyway, when you're a host, you got a host. You don't have the ability to eat and drink so much. So for the first 6 days of the party, he did not get drunk. He also was afraid of what might happen. However, on the seventh day, he finally said, okay, I finished showing off all my wealth. Now it's time for me to catch up. And he starts drinking, and he gets royally drunk, literally, because he was a royal. He gets royally drunk. Dangerous things happen when a man gets drunk. I had a friend of mine who says, I'm allergic to alcohol. Every time I drink, I break out in handcuffs. Now, so finally now, Ketov Lev, Bayom HaShvi'i, Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayin. It was only on the seventh day that the king got drunk with wine, because for the first 6 days, he did not get drunk. But now, the final day, he already finished showing off all of his wealth, and now it's finally time to catch up, and he is spiced, as the Gemara would say, spiced. And what does he tell? He tells all of his low-grade eunuchs, the local, you know, the servants who serve in the palace. What does he tell them to do? Lahavi es vashti hamalchah lefnei hamelech bekeser malchus laros hamim vasarim es yafiyah ki tovas marehi. He instructed them to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, to show the peoples and the nobles her beauty, for she was very good-looking. According to one opinion in the Gemara, she was one of the four most beautiful people in the history of the world. Okay, now, disaster is about to strike for Vashti, and it very, very much providentially happened on Shabbos. Oh my gosh, we're out of town, out of time. Okay, let's just finish this little piece over here. I mean, it's not little. Can you guys give me a few more minutes? Okay. Vashti used to force Jewish girls to work for her on Shabbos, unclothed, to cause them the ultimate humiliation. And because of that, she was going to be humiliated in the same way on a Shabbos. Now the Jews, even the Jews from Shushan, when it was time for Yom Kippur, they're like, it's Kol Nidre, I got to go home. So actually, the Jews were not present in mass at this party on the final day. And in that merit, at least they went home for Yom Kippur. You know, every little bit of movement is such a difference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When a Jew says, even something I'm going to do for Hashem, you think, what do you mean? You've been sitting here partying for 6 days in the king's party, or you go home for Yom Kippur? No. You'd make a move for God. Yesterday, someone told me, I was texting with somebody, and he said, you know, my wife and I stopped going places on Friday night. We stopped driving out on Friday night. It's a little step towards Shabbos. I called him up. I said, a little step? You stop driving on Friday night? Do you know how beloved that is to Hashem? To the Abishter. The Abishter is more Yiddish. I don't think he knew the word Abishter. I didn't say that. I said, do you know how much Hashem loves you? You take a little step to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so deeply appreciative. It's not a little step. It's a huge step. Your whole life you've been driving on Shabbos. And you say, I'm not going to drive Friday night anymore? I'm going to stay in and celebrate Shabbos with my wife at home? You call that a little step? That's such a beautiful big step. Hashem loves you, and He should bless you, that you should see more Shabbos light in your home and more success in your life. So true. The Jews were partying at the Seudah of Achashverosh for 6 days, and it was very wrong. They did get drunk. They did enjoy. They were improper. But they went home for Yom Kippur, and even that, at least, was enough of a merit to cause somewhat of their salvation. Now, in the Persian kingdom, Persians were much more uncouth than the Babylonians. The men would have their wives dance unclothed in front of their friends at a party. Like, that was so sick. And Ahasuerus was drunk enough to say, okay, I'll have my wife do it too. Now, everybody at the court was boasting. Remember, this is the kingdom of Paras Umadai, Persia and Media. So all the Persians are saying, oh, the Persians are the most beautiful women in the world. And the Medians are saying, the Medians are the most beautiful women in the world. And drunk Ahasuerus steps into the fray. My wife is not a Persian, and she's not a Median. She's a Babylonian, but she's the most beautiful woman in the world. And everyone's like, okay. He's like, I'll show you. And they said, what do you mean? You could dress a pig in royal clothing and she'll look beautiful. You know what I'm saying? Just enough makeup design and lighting, you know, and put a wig on. You know what I'm saying? So he says, no. I'm going to have her come out without anything on. And you're going to see that she's the most beautiful woman. Now, Vashti wanted the Jews to violate Shabbos because she knew that Shabbos gives us the greatest advantage. And listen to the statement. When Jews observe the Shabbos, Ein kol umma sholetas b'hem, no nation in the world has any power over the Jewish people. Someone called me up today. She wanted me to write billboards refuting all the crazy Hamas, you know, stuff from Dearborn. I'm like, billboards won't help. You want to help? Keep Shabbos. You want to help? Learn more Torah. You want to help? Reach out to a fellow Jew. Like, that's going to be so much more effective than trying to fight the narrative. You have a Hamas supporter shouting at you, you genocidal maniac! You're like, we're not really committing genocide because they attacked for... It's not worth it. When the Jews keep the Shabbos, nobody can touch us. When the Jews study Torah, when the Jews connect with one another, when the Jews love each other, no one touches us. Vashti also made a special effort to make the Jewish women sin. Because she realized, if you have a house where the woman goes immoral, when a woman goes low in a house, the husband goes lower. When a woman goes low in the house, the husband goes lower. It's easy. The easy job as Ahasuerus is trying to get the men to do immoral things. That's easy. Vashti said, I'm going to get the women to do immoral things, because the men will drop like stones. Also, it occurred on Yom Kippur. And this was the one day that the Jewish people, the Satan has no power. The Talmud tells us the Satan has no power. The Satan has no power in Yom Kippur. He controls 364 days of a year. As a matter of fact, the word HaSatan has the gematria of 364. One day a year he has no power. And this was the day that we were able to provide the knockout punch to our enemy Vashti and provide the seeds of the deliverance that she would be replaced by Esther. And that would be our thing. Interestingly enough, his attention was... Ahasuerus' whole plan was, we're going to get the Jews to sin. It's not only the last day of the party, they're all gone. So he says, now I got to come up with a new... I've been trying to wear down the Jewish people's resistance. They should be ready to commit adultery, but they're ashamed. So we got to dispel their inhibitions. If the queen comes out in such a lewd manner, it's going to take away the inhibitions for the entire kingdom. And even and the Jews, they always try to like show that they're more American than the Americans, more, you know, British than the British. And they see that the Persian king and queen are doing this, they're going to come along and they're going to follow too. And they'll sin so much that we can sleep peacefully, the temple will never be rebuilt. Of course, Ahasuerus ends up suffering an enormous loss of dignity. When people heard that he tried to call his wife to dance like that in such a promiscuous, disgusting way, they were so like, what kind of king tells his wife to do that? They actually lost respect for him, of course. But, of course, this... is what happens when a person gets drunk, and Hashem set it all up. The beginning of the downfall happens on Yom Kippur, the day the Satan has no power over the Jews. And with that, we'll conclude today. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being awesome.
You've just experienced another Torah class brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.